Okay. So this is a talk entitled The Gift Relationship. And I'd like to start by asking you all a question. And the question is, how many of you are heard of or have read anything by a woman called Ayn Rand? Well, there's a few of you. There's a few of you, good. But most of you, I think, probably won't know anything about her. But just over a year ago, in Goldsmith Hall, in the City of London, there was a meeting of several hundred bankers, economists, political advisers, business leaders, and they were there to hear the annual Ayn Rand lecture organised by the Adam Smith Institute. And the talk was entitled Ayn Rand, More Relevant Now Than Ever. And this talk was delivered by a man called Lars Seier Christensen, who is the chief executive officer of a Danish investment bank. And the audience heard him argue that the world is on the wrong track. And he concluded that Ayn Rand is the only answer. And the description of the meeting says the audience applauded enthusiastically to that statement. Now, she died in 1982, but she has a considerable influence, as you can see from the attendance at that meeting. In the 1990s, the United States Library of Congress did a survey, and from that survey it said that one of Ayn Rand's books, called Atlas Shrugged, was the second most influential book in the United States, second after the Bible. Paul Ryan, you may remember in the 2012 United States presidential election, he was the Republican vice presidential candidate. He's a prominent member of the United States Congress. He prepares the Republican Party's budget proposals. And he says that Ayn Rand is a major formative influence on his thinking. Alan Greenspan, who was the head of the United States Federal Reserve Bank for 20 years from the late 1980s. The United States Federal Reserve Bank is probably, if not the most, one of the most influential economic organizations in the world. He was the head of that. He was a friend and admirer of Ayn Rand. So who was she? And how is she relevant to this talk on the gift relationship? She was a Russian emigre, born in the early 1900s, who lived most of her life in the United States. And she wrote several novels in the 20th century to promote her philosophical views. She had and continues to have a major influence on key players in the modern capitalist world. She has a particular interest for us as Buddhists because she viewed altruism as a disease. A disease that is incompatible with freedom, with capitalism, and with individual rights. For her, altruism was a kind of primitive social instinct left over from our earlier evolution as humans. And she held the view that we are still in evolution as a species and living side by side with some missing links. We are part of those missing links because, she said, the missing links could be found, she thought, in those people who fail to utilise their rational selfishness to its full potential. She deeply believed that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest. And in her novel, Atlas Shrugged, the hero, John Galt, exclaims, "I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." And Ayn Rand's conclusion was that if any civilization is to survive, it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject. So it's difficult to imagine a view more completely opposed to everything that Buddhism stands for. In the Pali Canon of the early Buddhism, the Buddha exhorted his disciples to go forth for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, the good, and the happiness of gods and men. And in the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra of the Mahayana, the first of the four means of attraction that the Bodhisattva employs to build a Buddha land is generosity. So I want to look at generosity and altruism and how they are viewed now in modern economics. And I want to start by looking at a book, a wonderful book, called The Gift Relationship, that was published in 1970, written by a man called Richard Titmus, who was a professor of social administration at the London School of Economics. And in this book, he compared the blood donation systems then existing in the UK and the USA. So blood donation in the UK relied on people giving blood voluntarily for no financial reward. Blood was given as a gift. Donations of blood were then used for unknown strangers who received the blood at no charge. So the UK system existed outside the market rules of economics and relied upon altruism. Blood donation in the United States at that time relied very much upon commercial blood banks that paid donors for their blood and then sold the blood on. So the system in the USA was market-based. So what did Richard Titmus find in his study? Well, first of all, he found that the quantity and the quality of the blood donated in the UK was higher than that in the USA. In particular, the quality of the blood in the USA was poorer, because in a market for blood, those who had the greatest incentive to supply it for money were those often with the unhealthiest blood. You have to remember, in the 1960s, the systems for checking blood donations were much less well developed. So the unhealthiest people supplied blood often, especially drug and alcohol addicts, and they lied about their medical condition. So that was one thing that he found. But he had a deeper objection to the commercialization of the blood donor system. He believed that commercialization of the blood donor system eroded the spirit of altruism and generally diminished the propensity of people to give to others. In this way, he said, the gift relationship in society was undermined, something which he very much regretted. What he feared was the general erosion of moral values in society by the crowding out effect of market values through the process of commercialization. By eroding opportunities for people to be altruistic, the culture of giving would be diminished. So he wrote this book, and there was an immediate response from economists who didn't like it. And one of his main critics was an economist called Kenneth Arrow, a very distinguished American economist of that time. And it is worth explaining two of the assumptions behind his criticisms, because they tell us a lot about the mind of economists. The first assumption that Arrow made was that commercialization does not change people's propensity to be altruistic, to be generous. In the case of blood, he argued, commercialization means that those who wish to buy and sell it can do so, whilst those who wish to avoid the market and prefer to see blood as a gift can continue to do so and give blood for nothing. In this way, he said, everyone gains. He argued, economists typically take for granted that since the creation of a market increases the individual's area of choice, it therefore leads to higher benefits. Thus, if to a voluntary blood donor system we add the possibility of selling blood, we have only expanded the individual's range of alternatives. If he derives satisfaction from giving, he argued, he can still give, and nothing is done to impair that right. So, Arrow was arguing in the United States a person could choose to give blood as a gift, or to sell their blood. In the United States, the prospective donor had two options. In the UK, the option to sell your blood was denied. Therefore, the freedom of the potential donor was restricted. And since two freedoms are always better than one, the system that includes the market alternative, the possibility to sell your blood at a price, is superior to the one that denies that choice. This is the freedom of the market. There was a counter-argument to that, and I think a very good one, made by a man called Peter Singer, who's a moral philosopher, who some of you might have heard of. He pointed out that there are not two freedoms at stake here. There are, in fact, three freedoms. The first freedom is the freedom to donate blood for no financial reward. The second freedom is the freedom to sell blood. But there is a third freedom, and that freedom is the freedom to give blood as a priceless gift, whose value hinges solely on the need of the recipient, because it cannot be bought. So he said there are three freedoms, and in each country you will find two freedoms. In the United States you will find the freedom to give blood or to sell blood. In the UK you would find the freedom to give blood, and to give blood for the sake of giving, because you can't attach a value to a priceless gift. So the question is, do you dispense with the freedom to sell your blood, or with the freedom to give a priceless gift? And Singer said, this is ultimately a decision about the kind of society that we want to live in. So that's the first way that economists' minds work and how they can be challenged. But there's a second assumption behind Arrow's argument, and I think in some ways this is more insidious. And it's this. Arrow argues that altruism and generosity are resources, and like other resources, their supply is limited and therefore need to be economised. So he argued, markets which rely on people acting purely out of self-interest save us from having to use up a restricted supply of altruism. So if the supply of blood depends on people's generosity, then there will be less generosity left over for other situations. Now, I'm not making this up. This is what economists argue. So this is Arrow summarizes his argument. Like many economists, I do not want to rely too heavily on substituting ethics for self-interest. I think it best on the whole that the requirement of ethical behaviour be confined to those circumstances where the price system breaks down. We do not wish to use up recklessly the scarce resources of altruistic motivation. More recently, another economist has elucidated a very similar argument. It's a man called Lawrence Summers, United States economist. He was an advisor to President Bill Clinton. He's been an advisor to President Barack Obama. So you might think, good Democratic Party credentials in the United States. He was also the president of Harvard University. And it was at Harvard University that he elucidated his view on this matter. He gave a talk on what economics can contribute to thinking about moral questions. This is what he said. One of the things that bothers many people of faith about market mechanisms is the idea that there is something wrong with a system where we are able to buy bread only because of the greed or profit motive of the people who make the bread. Here I would be very cautious. We all only have so much altruism in us. Economists like me think of altruism as a valuable and rare good that needs conserving. Far better to conserve it by designing a system in which people's wants will be satisfied by individuals being selfish and saving that altruism for our families, our friends, and the many social problems in this world that markets cannot solve. So what I've tried to do in the beginning of this talk is to give you two views of altruism that have influence within economics. The first and most extreme of Ayn Rand, who sees altruism as a disease incompatible with freedom. The second, like the views of Kenneth Arrow and Lawrence Summers, which is a little bit more subtle, because they do see value in altruism, but they believe themselves to be preserving virtues for use where they are really needed by promoting selfishness and greed in the operation of economic markets. Now, to anyone not immersed in economics, this second argument, this way of thinking about altruism and generosity as resources with limited supply, rather like a fossil fuel that is diminished with every use, surely we can think that's incredibly bizarre. Actually, it doesn't need a Buddhist to see through it. You may have heard of Michael Sandel. He's given, I think it's the BBC Wreath Lectures talks a few years ago, and he wrote a book called What Money Can't Buy, which is a very good book. And in that book, he argued this: altruism, generosity, solidarity and civic spirit are not like commodities that are depleted with use. They are more like muscles that develop and grow stronger with exercise. One of the defects of a market-driven society is that it lets these virtues languish. To renew our public life, we need to exercise them more strenuously. And I think he's right. We don't need to think too much that he's dead right. But unfortunately, free market thinking is penetrating more and more deeply into our lives. In his book, What Money Can't Buy, Sandel gives us an example of how market thinking is creeping into discussion around immigration and refugees. He talks about a man called Gary Becker, who was a Nobel Prize winning economist from the University of Chicago. He entered the debate about immigrants. He made a very simple proposal. He said the United States should simply set a price and sell American citizenship for $50,000, maybe $100,000. And he argued that immigrants willing to pay a large sum of money are likely to be young, skilled, ambitious, hardworking, and even better, are unlikely to make use of welfare or unemployment benefits. That was his proposal. Now, a lot of people would balk at that. But there's another market proposal that overcomes some of the problems associated with that, put forward by an American law professor. And he proposed that there be an international body established that assigned each country in the world a yearly refugee quota based on the wealth of that country. So the wealthier the country, the higher the quota of refugees the country is assigned. But nations can buy and sell these quotas among themselves. So he gives this example. If Japan is allocated a quota of 20,000 refugees per year, but doesn't want to take them, it could pay Poland to take them in. According to the standard free market logic, everyone benefits. Poland gains a new source of national income. Japan meets its refugee obligations by outsourcing them. And more refugees are rescued than otherwise would find asylum. So Sandel ironically asks, what could be better? And then he goes on and he answers, there is something distasteful about a market in refugees, even if it leads to more refugees finding asylum. But what exactly is objectionable about it? It has something to do with the fact that a market in refugees changes our views of who refugees are and how they should be treated. It encourages the participants, the buyers, the sellers, and also those whose asylum is being haggled over to think as refugees as burdens to be unloaded or as revenue sources rather than as human beings in peril. What this example illustrates is that markets are not mere mechanisms. They embody certain norms. They presuppose and promote certain ways of valuing the goods being exchanged. And he emphasizes then, economists often assume that markets do not touch or taint the goods they regulate. But this is untrue. Markets leave their mark on social norms. And this is the nub of Richard Titmuss's original argument in The Gift Relationship about a market in buying and selling blood. In The Gift Relationship, Richard Titmuss argued that it's not just the blood that gets contaminated with the market. People's minds and values are contaminated with the market. The place in our society of important qualities like generosity and community is eroded to be replaced with selfishness and greed, and human beings and human qualities become commodities, things to be traded just like other commodities. Our modern economic marketplace corrupts our values and attitudes. Another way in which it does corrupt our values and attitudes is in the naked rejoicing in greed. Now, there's two very famous examples from the 1980s of the naked rejoicing in greed. First is a real-life example, a man called Ivan Bursky, who was a real-life Wall Street trader. The second was a film character, Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas in the film Wall Street. And in May 1986, Ivan Bursky, who was then a tremendously successful and famous Wall Street trader, gave a speech at the University of California Berkeley School of Business, in which he said, "Greed is all right, by the way. I want you to know that. I think greed is healthy. You can be greedy and still feel good about yourself." And the newspaper report of it says that people in the audience laughed and cheered and applauded. Later that year, he went to jail because he'd been engaging in illegal trading. But his words lived on in Gordon Gekko, the character played by Michael Douglas in the film Wall Street, a year later, in which Gordon Gekko says, "The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all its forms, greed for life, greed for money, greed for love, greed for knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind." And late in 2013, just over a year ago, our own Boris Johnson, London Mayor, declared that inequality is essential to fostering a spirit of envy, and he hailed greed as a valuable spur to economic activity, and he called upon the Gordon Geckos of London to display their greed to promote economic growth. So, you know, Gordon Gekko might be a fictional character, but his philosophy lives on very much amongst our own politicians. And we can see the work of greed there in the pay levels of chief executives of financial institutions and leading companies. These are interesting statistics, I think. At the end of the 1970s in the United States, if you were a chief executive of a major company, you probably earned about 26 times more than the pay of an average worker. Now, you might think 26 times more is too much of a difference. But in 2011 in the United States, chief executives earned 209 times the pay of their average worker. 209 times more money than the pay of their average worker. A massive rise in inequality. In the UK, we're not quite so extreme, but top bosses in the UK now get pay worth 130 times more than the pay of the average employee. I remember in the early 1970s, Peter Drucker, who was a very famous management consultant, thought that the maximum ratio allowable between the chief executive officer and their average pay of their workers should be 20 to 1. But now we're at 209 is the ratio in the United States, 130 in our country. So greed, in some ways, is rampant. Now, Buddhism offers an alternative ethical system and worldview to that of the free market. We know that generosity, love, and kindness can be cultivated and grown, just as Michael Sandel said, just like developing muscles with exercise. We know this. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the discourse on loving kindness, the Buddha urges us, "Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So, with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should retain this collection, sustain this recollection, rather. This is said to be the sublime abiding. This is why we practice the Metta Bhavana meditation. We are trying to grow and strengthen the virtues of kindness and love and diminish the power of self-centeredness and selfishness. Loving kindness and generosity are not commodities in limited supply. They are qualities of mind that can be cultivated in meditation and that grow in strength with repeated application in everyday life. The Buddha identified greed, hatred and delusion as the root causes of the human predicament. The Metta Bhavana meditation is the antidote for hatred and also weakens the delusion that we exist separately from others and from the world around us. The antidote for greed is generosity or altruism, the practice of giving. And in stark contrast to Ayn Rand, the Buddha once commented, "Those who don't praise giving are fools." In the teaching of the Buddha, the practice of giving is the foundation and the seed of spiritual development. In the Pali Suttas, the earliest recording teachings of the Buddha, we read time and time again that talk on giving was the first topic to be discussed by the Buddha whenever he was teaching. The practice of giving in the Pali Canon is the first of the 10 paramis or perfections. And in the Mahayana, the practice of giving is the first of the 6 perfections. And I mentioned earlier in the talk about the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra, the first of the 4 means of attraction that the Bodhisattva employs to build a Buddha land is generosity. And Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, commented once that it's as if the teaching is saying, you may not be morally scrupulous. You may not be able to meditate even for 5 minutes at a time. You may not dip into the scriptures from 1 year to the next. But if you aspire to lead any sort of higher life, then at the very least, you will give. So the practice is not just concerned with the act of giving something to another, but more about cultivating a personal quality of generosity, an inward disposition to give. A disposition that is strengthened by outward acts of giving. And it's interesting that the studies of blood donors show that although the initial decision to give blood may be influenced by a variety of factors, such as the convenience of a nearby clinic or by an appeal for blood, over time, the sense of an inner moral duty and the desire to help or to act on a feeling of responsibility to the community becomes more dominant. And the same studies suggest learning to give in one context carries over into other contexts. So the cultivation of generosity directly debilitates greed and facilitates the flexibility of mind that helps to destroy delusion. The individual practices of metta and generosity that we teach to others and that we put into effect in our daily lives are a small but vital part of the effort to counter the increasing erosion of moral values by free market economics. So what we do as individuals is important. But we can do more as a Sangha, as a Buddhist community, to promote moral values and to counter market forces. So this is where I think the idea of the Dana economy is important. A Buddhist Sangha can be a beacon, highlighting that there is an alternative to the selfishness and greed of market fundamentalism that increasingly permeates our society. We know that dana means giving, and the basic principle of a dana economy is give what you can, take what you need. Now, people associate that phrase very much with the Communist Manifesto written by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. But actually, in essence, that statement was around for a good while before then. Give what you can, take what you need. The precise details of how we put that into effect may differ from one Sangha to another, but its basic features are clear, I think. If we practice a Dana economy at a Buddhist centre, those who come to the classes are encouraged to give what they can afford to help enable the spread of the Dharma. And at the same time, the teachings of the Buddha are open to anyone, regardless of their individual financial circumstances. And the same principle of give what you can, take what you need, applies when it comes to levels of financial support given to those whose job it is to work at Buddhist centres and businesses operating a Dana economy. So the chairperson of a retreat centre or the managing director of a business is treated exactly the same as anyone else. They are financially supported according to what they need. So Manjubhadra and myself lived at Padmaloka for quite a few years together. We had very senior members of the order living there. I was the junior most mitra there when I arrived. I was older than many others, but I was the junior most mitra. And everybody got the same support. No matter how influential and important you were, you got the same support. If there were things to be done about the retreat centre, we all mucked in. Everybody was generous with their activities in different ways there. So there was no difference. The principle of give what you can, take what you need, was very clearly applied in that situation. Everybody gives according to the best of their ability. And it's not just confined to monetary giving. Of course, people can give freely of their time and skills in many ways. And in this way, the practice of generosity, the Dana economy, encourages a culture of sharing, encourages a basic ethos at the heart of the Sangha, at the heart of the Buddhist community. It helps to build a Buddha land in the middle of a hostile economic world. So I'm going to add a little bit more just to conclude in a minute, but in the group discussions, you might want to think about two areas. The first is, what can we individually do to encourage a culture of generosity and to counter the market values that are dominant in our society? What can we do individually to encourage a culture of generosity and to counter the market values dominant in our society? And how can we as a Sangha collectively promote a culture of generosity? Can we do more to promote a culture of generosity? But I want to conclude by a story about generosity. It's a story told by a man called Taitetsu Ono, a leading Pure Land Buddhist practitioner in the United States who died recently. And it's a story that reminds us of the power of individual acts of giving. It's a story about three grapefruits. In 1968, Ono and his family were visiting Japan, and they received a gift of three grapefruits. At that time, a very rare and very expensive fruit in Japan. And since they were just about to return to California, where grapefruits were abundant and cheap, they decided to give away the three grapefruits to the wife's teacher at a flower arranging class. A few days later, the teacher sent them a letter, and Taitetsu Ono describes its contents. She wrote that she shared the first grapefruit with her grandchildren, who were thrilled with the fragrance and taste of an exotic fruit that they had never seen before. The second grapefruit she peeled and ate together with an old friend whom she hadn't seen for over 20 years, making the reunion a very special event. The third grapefruit she took to a hospital where her best friend was dying of a terminal illness. She hadn't eaten for more than a week. But when she saw the grapefruit, she wanted to try tasting just a little piece. When she finished the first morsel, she asked for another one, then another one, until she managed to eat half the grapefruit. And the family members watching all this were in tears, happy that their loved one was enjoying something to eat. The teacher thanked us profusely from the bottom of her heart for the three grapefruits. And Ono reflected that according to Huayan Buddhism, which is a Chinese Buddhist tradition based on the Flower Garland Sutra, a small act of giving has wider effects in an interdependent and interconnected world. And Ono concluded, no one can measure the effects of a single act of giving, for its repercussions are beyond our limited imagination. Thank you.